I recognize that there's a lot of citizens outside of Southeast Alaska that might just think this is a ghastly thing to do.
The legislature prepares to debate a bounty on otters in Southeast. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, I did rod musher Aaron Burmeister on his surprise leaders.
It's very fun. It's made it a lot of fun to watch her on the run, and just gives you something to be excited about for the future because she's a great little dog.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A plane crashed this morning in the McClung Hills, 20 miles northeast of Dillingham. Authorities understand that a pilot and co-pilot were on board at the time of the crash, but no names have been released. As KDLG's Dave Benninger reports, poor weather has made rescue and recovery efforts nearly impossible today.
The wreckage was spotted from the air at about 10 a.m. Friday morning, reportedly still smoking. That pilot said that there was zero visibility around the McClung Hills and indicated that the crash site seemed to be very near to the site of the 2010 crash that killed Senator Ted Stevens. The weather has hampered search and rescue efforts throughout the morning. The state troopers, Coast Guard Station Kodiak, Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, local air assets, and volunteers with the Dillingham Fire Department and Search and Rescue were all coordinating on how best to reach the crash site. About a dozen volunteers and EMTs left Dillingham on snow machines at 11 a.m., but just a half an hour later, a decision was made to call the ground effort back. It was judged that above-freezing temperatures and rain have created unsafe conditions for travel, and the wreckage is reportedly at an altitude that may not be achievable by those on the ground. By 12:30 p.m., a helicopter from Coast Guard Station Kodiak had arrived on scene and was flying over the crash site. It was soon replaced by an Alaska Air National Guard HH-60 Pavehawk helicopter and a C-130, both reportedly with Guardian Angel pararescue crews aboard. As of 3 p.m., the Air National Guard reported that their pilots could not locate the crash site and would not be able to deploy pararescue crews until visibility improved. The Acer cargo plane was en route to Dillingham from King Salmon. The cause of the crash is unknown. Both the NTSB and the FAA will be investigating. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
One-third of the state legislature is in Washington, D.C. right now, meeting with oil and gas lobbyists. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, they're attending the annual meeting of the Energy Council, a group consisting of Alaska, 10 other states, 4 Canadian provinces, and the Venezuelan government.
Neither the Energy Council nor its affiliated nonprofit, CLEAR, has a website. They're headquartered at the same address in Dallas, Texas. And the Energy Council's filings with the government list its mission as serving as a forum for governmental entities to discuss energy and environmental policy issues. That was on full display Friday morning at the elegant Washington Court Hotel. Kansas State Senator Carolyn McGinn kicked off the conference by thanking the sponsors.
Today's luncheon is sponsored by another longtime friend of the Energy Council, Mr. Mike McGarry of the Nuclear Energy Institute.
McGinn went on.
Tomorrow's breakfast will be hosted by Sarah Tise of Exxon Oil.
Also on the list of attendees, Bill Bracken, ExxonMobil's lobbyist in Alaska, Portia Babcock, ConocoPhillips' chief lobbyist in Alaska, Michelle Egan with the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Nikki Martin from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, Rick Rogers, the executive director of the Resource Development Council for Alaska. The list goes on and includes about 20 members of the legislature. Some brought spouses, others brought staffers. The Energy Council chairman is Sitka Republican Bert Stedman. Senator Stedman had the honor of introducing Billy Tazan. Tazan, a Democrat turned Republican, is also a congressman turned D.C. lobbyist. Stedman told the crowd there's something to learn from Tazan's career.
As a Democrat, he didn't have Republican opposition. Then he swapped to the Republicans and didn't have Democratic opposition. So we should all aspire to those goals, getting elected and not having opposition.
Tizan regaled the attendees, who were busy eating plates of bacon and eggs, with stories of a different Washington, of a Washington where opposing lawmakers would come together to work on energy or to fix the tax code. He's lobbying to protect certain federal tax provisions for oil producers.
But as long as we have it, there are provisions in that tax code that are critical to the production of energy in this country. And to strip them out just for the sake of saving a few billion dollars in a $16 trillion deficit situation makes little sense to me.
Some lawmakers have proposed cutting $2 to $4 billion in tax credits to the oil industry as a way to offset spending.
There's one particular provision in the code which I'm working on trying to preserve, which affects ConocoPhillips, Alaska, which is a sponsor of this organization meeting today. It's called dual capacity.
Tizan says that provision prevents U.S.-based oil companies from double taxation on foreign-earned money, meaning if they bring the money back to the U.S., they won't be taxed on it.
More and more of our companies are seeing more of their revenue from foreign sales.
Tizan is lobbying to protect federal interests. But the lobbyists in town from Alaska will have plenty of time to make the lower taxes pitch to state lawmakers this weekend. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Legislation proposing sea otter bounties will get its first hearing next week. It's already drawing opposition from environmental groups and the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Agency. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Fishermen harvesting Dungeness crab, geoduck clams, and some other ocean floor species have been coming up empty in recent years. The reason is the rapid expansion of the sea otter population. The marine mammals mostly eat clams, but as they bring their voracious appetites into new areas, they clear out many of the shellfish sought by commercial subsistence and personal use divers and fishermen.
So what we're trying to do is come up with some assistance for the folks in the area that want to go out and harvest them to afford to be able to do so.
Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman represents Cake, Prince of Wales Island, and other coastal southeast communities where otters have moved in. He's authored a bill that would give Alaska natives, the only people who can legally hunt marine mammals, a $100 reward for each pelt they take.
You've got your costs of your fuel and other items you need. Also, there's tanning cost issues, and we're just trying to assist in the harvest.
Otters were once widespread along the West Coast, from California out to the Aleutians. Russian and American hunters virtually wiped them out, except for a few remote areas. They were reintroduced to Southeast about 50 years ago. Recent studies say their numbers are growing by as much as 12% a year in some places. Federal legislation protects otters, only allowing Alaska natives to harvest them for traditional purposes. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesman Bruce Woods says states can't impose bounties.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act prohibits any state from enforcing a law that affects the take of a marine mammal without first soliciting and receiving management authority for that species from the Secretary of the Interior.
The agency is working with native hunters and craftspeople to better define the legal use of pelts. That could increase the overall harvest. Opposition to the bill is growing among some of the same organizations that campaigned against wolf control. They say otter population growth is a good thing.
They're a keystone species.
Tina Brown is president of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. She points out that otters eat sea urchins, which eat kelp. That allows coastal Southeast to return to more of its natural balance.
When you have the kelp forest, you have nurseries for finfish. And it's thought that the kelp forests can increase herring populations, salmon populations. Another benefit is they help reduce CO2 emissions and slow ocean acidification.
And what about the hunters? Tlingit Haida Central Council Economic Development Director Carrie Sykes has been working on the issue. She says tribal members have mixed feelings.
Some people think that it would be a good idea and that it could help offset the costs of the hunting and tanning. Others are worried about what the perception will be from, you know, different organizations like Defenders of the Wildlife, and we're not really sure how it would work.
She says local tribes have more influence on the issue than the regional central council. Stedman, the Senate bill's author, says it should be considered a first draft. He expects changes as it's considered by the legislature. He also expects organized opposition.
And I recognize that there's a lot of citizens outside of Southeast Alaska that might just think this is a ghastly thing to do. But I can assure you we're better prepared to take care of our own backyard than people in San Francisco and Florida are.
Stedman's legislation comes before the Senate Resources Committee on March 13th. The House version, introduced by Anchorage Republican Representative Cherise Millett, is not yet scheduled. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, preparing for the wearable art show in Sitka.
The person is the canvas, let's do it, say it like that. And you're finding some kind of material to put on that person as a canvas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Martin Boozer has the lead in this year's Iditarod. He left the village of Grayling early this afternoon for the 62-mile run to the Eagle Island checkpoint. Allie Zirkel, Aaron Burmeister, Jake Berkowitz, and Sonny Lindner round out the top five. Iditarod mushers start the race with up to 16 dogs. They can drop dogs along the trail, but they have to finish with six. Many mushers will drop dogs at the Iditarod checkpoint after completing the longest single run along the trail. But as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, most teams remain large more than halfway through the race.
A calm evening turned into a blustery night as gusting winds rustled dry grass outside the musher cabin. But the weather hasn't affected Jake Berkowitz. A number of mushers have referred to his team as a freight train. He started the race with 16 dogs. As the wind picked up, he pulled out of Iditarod with all of them.
I've never driven a team that's this competitive and this eager to go at the same time.
Only a few teams haven't dropped any dogs halfway through the race. The majority of mushers have only dropped two or three. Aaron Burmeister left Iditarod with 15 dogs. He says it's a sign of high-quality dog care. When he started the race, he had a few dogs he wasn't sure about.
I mean, the team as a whole is great, but a little dog that I never would have considered ever, even dreaming of taking her on Iditarod, she's just kind of the token dog in the kennel that we kept training and kept working with and kept her in shape. Her name is Java. She's about a little 40-pound black female, and she's a great little dog, great personality, but I got her for breeding.
But Java stepped up. She's been running in lead for the team.
It's very fun. It's made it a lot of fun to watch her on the run, and just gives you something to be excited about for the future because she's a great little dog.
Lance Mackey is running an entirely new team of dogs this year. The four-time champion has won the race with 15, but he's also driven teams as small as seven. He says he wants his crew of young, inexperienced dogs to enjoy the race.
You know, no matter what they do from here on out, it's been a stellar performance for this group. And the, you know, you can't help but smile seeing the young ones stand up and eat and, you know, doing the things I want to see them doing.
Vets say the majority of dogs dropped so far have had minor wrist and shoulder injuries. No one's seen what they refer to as a red dog. It's a dog that needs to be flown out of a checkpoint for immediate medical attention. On the Iditarod Trail in Iditarod, I'm Emily Schwing.
A citizen review committee has weighed in on the proposed Fairbanks North Star Borough School District budget for next year. The more than $262 million operating budget represents a 1% increase over the current year. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the district anticipates a funding shortfall and has proposed teacher cuts that the Citizen Committee disagrees with.
The school district anticipates it'll cost $8 million more to maintain the same level of service next year, mostly due to increased employee wage and health insurance costs. The administration has proposed teacher cuts as part of measures to accommodate that and the possible loss of some state and local money. At a school board work session and public hearing Thursday, Citizens Budget Review Committee member Becky Williams lined out the group's priority if government funding falls short.
There's a possibility that there's $4 million that we may not receive from state and local funding. And in the event that that does happen, we still want to keep class size where it needs to be. And if we do have to increase, that we do not increase K through 6.
The administration has proposed elimination of 14 teacher positions to cover the anticipated shortfall. That change equates to slightly larger class sizes, on the order of 1 to 1.5 additional students per class. Williams said $2.5 million is needed to avert the teacher cuts, and she lined out some alternative places the Citizens Committee has come up with to trim the budget.
Flat funding travel, flat funding the supplies budgets for all the departments, reducing the professional and technical budgets back to where they were last year, which is a savings of $100,000, and postponing the curriculum change for math, which will save us $1 million in the budget.
Williams said the committee also opposes the proposed addition of new assistant principals and an IT director.
We really felt like it was important to not increase the administrative side of things if we were having to cut classroom.
Other cost-cutting recommendations Williams said the committee came up with include a district-wide decrease in overtime, substitute, and temporary work, downsizing a summer school program to better match an expected decrease in demand, and a 10% rent hike for district facilities. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Former Alaska Governor Bill Sheffield says it's time for Alaska to build its own gas pipeline. Sheffield has been stumping around the state on his dime to promote the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, or ASAP. He told the Juneau Chamber of Commerce yesterday that the acronym is appropriate because Alaska is on the threshold of an energy crisis and needs the gas as soon as possible.
Too many of our residents are struggling to deal these days with bills to heat their homes and cook their meals that add up to the price of a monthly mortgage.
Once called the Bullet Line, the current proposal under the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation would take natural gas from Prudhoe Bay to South Central Alaska. Sheffield says the decline of Cook Inlet production is driving up commercial and domestic energy costs. He says the in-state gas line could help the Kenai Agrium plant reopen, rejuvenate the Flint Hills refinery near Fairbanks, and spur other business and industry along the way. While the gas pipeline would mainly serve the interior and south central region of the state, Sheffield believes surplus gas could be shipped to other parts of Alaska, including southeast, and could be sold to other countries. Sheffield, a Democrat, served as governor from 1982 to 1986.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, a fashion show. Right now, as you're listening to this, a group of Sitka residents are preparing to walk the runway. But they've traded in the usual fabrics for more eccentric media. Maybe it's a dress that's all zippers, or a suit made out of nautical charts, or a purse composed of bicycle valve stems. In the fashion world, this might be called madness. In Sitka, it's called wearable art. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Go ahead, it's okay. You can sway back and forth. We know you want to. That's what Jen Lawler is doing right now, ever so slightly, wearing a big black hoop skirt. She makes her way down a long runway that extends off the stage at Harrigan Centennial Hall, and when she gets to the end, she takes two rolls of what looks like receipt tape and puts them on the ground delicately on either side of her. The end of each roll is affixed to her waist, and as she walks back toward the stage,
It unfurls, stretching the entire length of the runway behind her, like a bridal train. This is dress rehearsal for Sitka's Wearable Arts show, and Lawler is wearing a piece of art called Stately Dance. It was designed by Connie LaPerriere. She's in the hallway after the rehearsal, gathering up the tape and stuffing it into a bag.
It's recycled paper. I used to work at the post office, so it's what the strips for putting on at the front counter come off of.
You know, it's that glossy backing that you peel stickers from. Once the tape is unfurled, there's no way to restuff it, but...
I have a lot of rolls. I've been saving it for some time. But the thing about it is, that was only one quarter of the roll.
That was only a quarter of the roll?
Right.
And it stretched the whole length of the runway. On the other side of the building, Bill Foster is down on one knee, tying his shoe in the men's dressing room.
I'm the oldest person in the show, I think, today.
How old are you?
74.
Foster's putting on a sailor suit, the kind they wear in the U.S. Navy, except sewn onto the pants and top are nautical signal flags.
Well, I've had the flags. There's 40 nautical flags, but I could only get 13 on the suit.
But,
however, I hope it works out that I have the longest wearable art entry ever to show you the rest of the 40 flags. Yeah, you'll see.
You're not giving away any.
I cannot say much right now because it hadn't worked yet.
When it's his turn to rehearse, Foster makes his way to the wing and then appears suddenly. In the arch right at center stage. He fiddles with something. We can't quite see it from the auditorium. And then he begins to back his way down the runway. As he does, signal flags emerge from the top of his shirt and out of his chest, tethered to a hook at the back of the stage. And yes, Bill Foster, age 74, is up there rocking out to In the Navy by the Village People because, as he explained,
one reason I chose it, it's the only disco tune with the word oceanography in it.
As good a reason as any. Foster's signal flag sailor suit and all of the pieces here are called wearable art, and organizers like Jeff Budd are very emphatic about that term.
Don't call it a costume. It's not a costume.
Why?
It's because it's wearable art, and it's art made to... Oh, Ed... How long a pause can I make?
What's the difference?
Can buy a costume. You can get online and you can buy a costume and you can be, what's his name from Kiss? You can be Michael Jackson. You can be anybody you want. But in wearable art, you have to make the outfit. And the person is the canvas. Let's say it like that. And you're finding some kind of material to put on that person as a canvas. People have taken fish bones and made them so intricate, and then they make it, weave it into the fabric. People have taken Usnier, old man's beard, and found ways to press that and do that. So
Bud says it's not a costume. It's art that is applied to a person. Wearable art is not Sitka's invention. This show is only in its fifth year. Bud gives credit to another Southeast community, Ketchikan, where the show just marked its 27th year. Back at the auditorium... Bill Foster reels in his flags and dances back upstage to make his exit. This is his third show. Last year, he covered himself in vintage Alaska Airlines baggage tags, and the time before that, he wore license plates and marched to Johnny Cash's I've Been Everywhere Man. Why does he do it? Why not? For AK, I'm Ed Ronco in the in Sitka.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Unalakleet, an Iditarod checkpoint on the Bering Sea coast.
My name is Jay Thomas, and I am the principal at Unalakleet School. It's right on the edge of the Norton Sound, or part of the Bering Sea. We are at the mouth of the Unalakleet River. Small delta, kind of spreads out quite a bit. And behind the town, there's a slough. There's kind of a point that goes out toward the river, and the community of Unalakleet is on that point between the slough, the river, and the Bering Sea. Unalakleet itself is, there's several things very, very unique about it. Unalakleet is the first village on the Iditarod, the first village on the Bering Sea coast. So they will stay on the Bering Sea coastline all the way to Nome. Our district student broadcasting team has covered the Iditarod for the past six, seven, 8 years.
4 or 5 years ago when Jeff King won that Iditarod. It was a Unicollegiate student who was the only one that he would grant an interview with when he was here in town. We are one of the few rural communities in Alaska with paved streets in the community and a paved runway. So Unicollegiate is a hub to 5 or 6 other smaller villages in our area. We have several mushers. There's a dog mushing group here. So we have several mushers in town who have been active and ran the Iditarod several times. And so we have families who have been involved in it since the inception. And so, yeah, the community is very involved. Our school itself, something that we're pretty proud of, and very few schools have been able to do that since the inception of No Child Left Behind and the scoring for adequate yearly progress. Our school here in Unicollegiate has never not been able to make AYP. But we get an awful lot of wind, and so the wind chill is what really gets people out here. It's equally as non-forgiving if you make a mistake in this area, just with the bitter wind chills. This is my 12th year in Alaska, so I've been in several different places. I love the remoteness of it. I mean, I was one of the few people disappointed when we got cell service. I like being off the road system. It's a great place to live and work.
Jay Thomas is principal at the school in Unalakleet. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Ronco, Alex Duware, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2013 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 16th through the 23rd. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.